Mormon Stories Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation. All donations to Mormon Stories are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonstories.org. Hello and welcome to part two on a series of Mormon Stories, on a series discussion about the psychology of religion. I'm here with Dr. James Nagel. Hey, James.
Hello.
Hey, and I just want to remind our listeners that all of this not only is available in audio format, but also up on YouTube at youtube.com/Mormon Stories. You can see the videos that correspond to what we're going to be talking about, or you can download the PowerPoints from mormonstories.org. But the visuals are extremely helpful, so check them out if you can. I'm here with James, and the first hour, we've already talked about a little bit of background, but mostly we talked about a few things. Let me see if I can recap, James. Mm-hmm. Number one is that people are susceptible to, highly susceptible to social influences and to peer pressure. To the point where they will often conform to things that they either don't believe at all, or that they if they question, they're you know, oftentimes likely to conform to the peer pressure, to social pressure around them. We also know
conformity. Yes.
Yep. We also know that the extent to which there's some uncertainty and high stakes coupled together, you're going to see an actual increase in conformity.
Yes.
Finally, that if there's a dissenting voice, even if there's a lot of peer pressure, one dissenting voice can make a pretty big difference in whether or not people conform.
Yes, dissent is a key variable.
Yeah. Okay, so that's what I think we've learned so far. And now we're on to cognitive dissonance. Is that right?
Yes. So we're looking at the first slide here.
Okay.
And we're going to introduce a field of psychology called cognitive dissonance theory. So we're just going to look at one of the classic experiments on this field. But something I wanted to emphasize throughout this discussion is, you know, we're just kind of cherry picking the really fun and dramatic experiments. But the psychology literature is just littered with dozens and hundreds of experiments of these same varieties, where they confirm and reinforce or even supplement a lot of these studies we've been giving. So it's not like these are just a single study in a vacuum. Okay. Every time I show you something, there's probably a series of a dozen or so follow-ups that have filled in a lot of the gaps and reproduced these results.
Got it.
So now we're going to talk about this idea of cognitive dissonance. And this idea was introduced to me indirectly when I was a teenager, I guess. Yeah, I remember, you know, like all teenagers, we go through this sort of crisis of your faith, right? You know, you're not sure if you believe or not, and you got your mission coming, and you have all this pressure to regularly attend church and prepare for your mission. And I remember, you know, being very unsure whether or not if I genuinely believe this stuff. So a lot of people, like including my bishop and Mormon friends, when I would explain this feeling to them, I was very strongly encouraged to just simply act as if I believed anyway. You know, in a sense, you know, like the seed of faith was basically saying, if you don't believe, just start taking part in the experience and acting as if you do. You know, go to the church and pay your tithing, take part in the activities and the charity events, and see if it works for you.
And say you believe.
Yeah, and a key variable in there that people often encouraged me was bear your testimony. As in, you know, even if you don't really believe this stuff, stand up and bear your testimony anyway. So one quote I remember receiving, you know, a friend like emailed this to me, was from Boyd K. Packer, saying a testimony is to be found in the bearing of it. You know, and I found that very odd because I felt uncomfortable. You know, if I don't really believe this, is it really an honest thing to stand up and say I believe it?
Right.
So another, this idea is, you know, not exactly a rare incident. In 2008, Dallin H. Oaks really reinforced this with one of his talks, where you have a quote here. It says, "We gain or strengthen a testimony by bearing it." And if you continue with the quote, it's, you know, some people even suggested that testimonies are better gained on the feet bearing them than on the feet than on your knees praying for them. Hmm. You've heard that quote before?
No, that's interesting.
So it's interesting because I don't think Dallin Oaks realizes how right he is.
Or maybe he does.
Maybe he does. The thing to be careful of, though, is that this works for anything.
Yeah.
Okay, if we were talking about the Pope and I gave you this exact same motivational speech and encouraged you and you took part in it, then it would lead you to a testimony of the Pope and the Catholic faith.
Yeah, and if you think about like the Jews and the Bar Mitzvah and the Bat Mitzvah, or the Catholics and the First Communion, or the Muslims and the, you know, the madrasas and the schools, it's clear that religions train their children from a very young age to say they believe stuff, you know, before they're probably able to really truly investigate.
Yeah, just sort of go through the motions, even if you don't understand it.
Yeah, yeah.
So the key idea, though, is this concept of you gain a belief by expressing a belief.
Got it. Yeah.
And that's what we're going to illustrate here in the next slide.
All
slide number two. It's called Fessinger and Carl Smith, the Cognitive Consequences of Forced Compliance. This is a really fun experiment just because it's so twisted and insidious and subtle what they did to these poor subjects. So I love talking about it just because it's very funny and entertaining to go through it. So it begins by pretending you are a subject. You just volunteered for a psychology experiment. And all you're told is it has something to do with thinking processes. So remember those nicknames I tell you. They like to come up with some fancy nickname that sounds all scientific-y but doesn't really mean anything, right?
Okay.
So you show up, you know, you're in this, you know, laboratory setting, and you are greeted by an official scientist, okay? They literally say in the paper that he put on a lab coat and had a clipboard ready and was geared to look as scientific-y as he could.
Okay.
So he sits you down at a desk and says, you know, thank you for joining. I would like you to do some experiments for me and complete some tasks. So the first task is you're presented with a tray sitting on a table, and around it are just a bunch of spools, you know, some random little knickknacks. And you are told, using only one hand, I want you to insert all the spools into the tray. Okay, so you see the first picture on the left is an empty tray with spools, and then on the right is a tray with spools in it.
Right.
So that's pretty easy, right? You know, 1, 2, 11, 12, done. That was easy. And while you're doing this, he's got his clipboard and his pencil, and he's watching you very intently. He scribbles all sorts of crazy notes on his clipboard and gives you the overall impression that this task is of the utmost scientific importance.
Okay.
So once you finish, you put them all in. He says, great, very good. Now I want you to take them all out again using only one hand. So, okay, you know, you take them out. 1, 2, 11, 12. Okay, that was easy. And again, he's scribbling his notes and watching you very intently. And then once you're done, he says, very good. Now I want you to put them all back in again. And you repeat this cycle for a full half hour. Take them out, put them in. Take them out, put them in.
So it's this menial, tedious task.
Exactly. It's completely monotonous. You're not really doing anything constructive. You're just being very dull and repetitive.
Got it.
Okay. But, you know, the science guy, you know, he's got his lab coat. You're in the laboratory, the sterile environment.
Right.
And he's watching you very intently.
Got it.
So next slide, slide number three. Obviously, you're going to get a little bored after a half hour of this.
Yep.
So maybe now he gears you up for the next section
a
of the experiment.
One. So there's a change.
Yes. Maybe something will be different.
Yeah.
It'll be more exciting this time. So he presents you with a tray with a bunch of square pegs in square holes. And you are instructed, using only one hand, rotate the pegs by 90 degrees one at a time.
Oh, boy.
And it's like 48 pegs here in front of you. So, okay, 1, 2, 3, so on all the way down. And you see the picture there. All the pegs are pointed up, and then you rotate them all 90 degrees.
Got it.
And then once you finish, he says, great, great, very good, thank you. Now do it again.
Oh, man.
You repeat over 48 pegs,
okay.
And he scribbles away. He says, thanks, now do it again, and again, and again, for another full half hour.
Right. So an hour of boring, monotonous
Exactly.
Okay.
So I have a little quote here from the paper. It says this, the hour which the subject spent working on the repetitive, monotonous tasks was intended to provide for each subject uniformly an experience about which he would have a somewhat negative opinion. Okay.
Right.
That's the scientific way of saying we bored them out of their skulls.
Now, you're not trying to draw parallels to sacrament meeting here, are you?
No, of course not.
Okay. I'm just kidding. I'm just joking. I actually enjoy sacrament meeting. I was just funny.
So the key here is, you know, they put you through an hour of complete boredom.
Okay.
The tasks you did were completely aimless and pointless and repetitive. Okay, so now we go to the next slide.
All right.
Slide number 4. Now that you've finished your hour of boredom, you are presented with a survey.
Okay.
On a scale from -5 to +5, please rate your response to the following questions. Number 1, were the tasks interesting and enjoyable? Number 2, do you think the results may have scientific value? And number 3, would you have any desire to participate in another similar experiment? Okay. So remember, these were boring by design.
Right.
So it shouldn't come as any particular surprise when all the subjects rate their experience at about the 0 level. Okay? You know, it was boring and unpleasant, but at least they weren't, you know, putting you through electroshock, right?
And because the guy had the lab coat on, it was scientifically valuable because clearly he's gathering important data.
Yeah, so you give them the benefit of the doubt, okay. But the key, though, is this is the control group, and they all came in at about zero-ish on this scale.
It.
That's the baseline to be aware of.
Okay
and that should be obvious, or nothing surprising about this.
Right.
So we now go to the next phase of the experiment.
Okay.
So that's all the control guys, and you got to feel bad for them. They just came in, do something boring for an hour, and then report that it was boring and leave. Thank you. We have our control group. So the next group comes along. They go through that hour of boredom, okay?
Okay.
So they're now bored out of their skulls and frustrated and want to strangle themselves. But you're not given the survey right away. Instead, they put you through this big elaborate song and dance, okay? So it basically goes like this. You know, you finish the tasks and you're about ready to jump into the next phase of the experiment. And the science guy starts looking very agitated. You know, he's looking at his watch, he's fidgeting and scratching his chin a little and looking like he's in a bit of a stressful condition. So he talks to you for a minute and says, "We need to get to the next phase of the experiment." But the guy who normally does it, he called in sick. So we're shorthanded. We need to think of something quickly. So since you just went through the experiment, would you mind taking part in the next section and filling in for this guy who was supposed to be here? So most people are pretty eager to help. You know, they cleared out their afternoon already, so they've got time on their hands. And he tells you your job is to go to the waiting room, and there you'll find a girl sitting there. So the subjects were male, and there happens to be a female there, just sitting in the waiting room, waiting for her turn to go through the experiment. Your job is to sit down with her and motivate her, okay? That is, you have to get her prepped up and ready to engage in these monotonous tasks.
Right.
They don't call them monotonous.
Right.
It's just, you know it's monotonous. But your job is to sit down and make the following points. It was very enjoyable. I had a lot of fun. I enjoyed myself. It was very interesting. It was intriguing, and it was exciting.
So lie through your teeth, basically.
Yeah, exactly. I think they even, I'm not sure, I think they actually like, even gave you like a checklist, a little card, so you'd remember to make these points directly.
Okay. All right.
So you have to describe the experiment in exciting terms, even though you just went through it, and it was boring.
Okay.
Okay. Your job, go lie to this person, please. Okay, tell them something untrue.
Right.
That's the key. They go through this whole elaborate song and dance just to put you into this predicament.
Okay.
So that brings us now to the next slide, slide number 6. So they broke it down into two groups. The first group, as a reward for, you know, their help in this experiment, they're offered $20.
Okay.
Now, a key thing to realize, this is 1959. Okay, so if you adjust for inflation, the $20 by today's standards is somewhere between $100 to $150 in value.
Okay.
So that's like a lot of money for barely 10 minutes of work, right?
Right.
So, okay, I'd feel pretty good about that. So effectively, you know, let's talk about this in terms of today's standards. Would you sit down with someone for 5 minutes and tell them a little white lie if there was $100 in it?
Yeah, and if I thought it was good, if it was part of science, you know, I'd say, yeah, it's okay.
Yeah, my conscience is pretty clear with that. What was $150?
Yeah.
You know, you might be inclined to feel a little guilty for bending the truth a little, but you know, $150 is a pretty heavy justification for that, right?
Yeah, if it's science and it's not really hurting people, right?
Yeah, it's a little white lie. You're not really hurting this person.
Right.
So what we say is these people had what you would call sufficient justification.
Okay.
Their conscience is clear. Okay. So they go in, they give the prep talk to the girl in the waiting room, and they come back, you know, they're given their money, and then they are sat down and given the survey again. So remember, the survey was, you know, did you think the tasks were enjoyable? Would you like to participate again in the future? And do you think they have scientific value? So they give them the survey again, and this group, nothing changed. They came in about the same as the control group. You look at all the bars there on that chart and average them together, and it's about zero-ish again, just like the control group. So that's why we say sufficient justification. They went up, they lied, and they felt okay with that and still reported, yes, the experiment was dull and silly and a waste of my time. Okay. So now we go on to group B. So now we're on slide number 7. This group, instead of offered $20, or by today's standards, you know, $100, they're offered $1. So you adjust for inflation, that's maybe like $5 by today's standards. Okay. So again, put yourself in this person's shoes. You're basically lying your teeth off to this poor girl, and your only reason for doing it is because you're getting $5. Mm-hmm. How would your conscience feel about that? Mm. You know,
I would.
Would you be uncomfortable with that, maybe? You know, some of us might. At least a little part of you in the back of your brain might get a little agitated and uncomfortable with this action. So there's actually a word for that in psychology. We call that cognitive dissonance. It's basically that awkward feeling your brain gets when your beliefs are not coinciding with your actions. Okay, sort of like a feeling of guilt. Okay,
and you're not receiving some big reward that kind of makes your cognitive dissonance disappear, right?
Yeah, exactly. So we call that insufficient justification. So you're stretching the truth, and you have insufficient justification for doing so. So what would your brain do? Well, it's too late to undo your action. You're already there lying your teeth off. So you can't stop lying. You can't come clean because that would spoil the experiment. So what happens is your brain actually adjusts itself to suit your actions. We like to think that our brain, you know, is this thing underneath our control, but it will actually, your belief subconsciously shifts to represent your actions. And that's what you see after the fact. So they go in, they motivate the girl, they come back. And remember, again, they're given the survey. You know, were the tasks interesting and enjoyable? Would you like to participate again? And do they have scientific value? And you look at all the results, and there's like a full point and a half shift towards the positive rating.
Where they say they enjoyed it, they had a good time, and it was highly valuable for science.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And you know, the shift is fairly subtle, but you can see just across the board, it is a significant shift.
Yeah.
That is a full point difference between the other two groups.
Right.
So this is the essence of what cognitive dissonance theory predicts, is when your beliefs are not in line with your actions, your beliefs tend to shift to align with your actions. Okay, that is, or to put it another way, is I'm not really lying to this person. The tasks really were interesting. Yay, I'm not lying anymore, right? They were actually kind of fun. They were pretty interesting.
And another example is, if you ever gotten in a fight with a spouse or a girlfriend where you kind of knew that they were wrong, sometimes they're the most vehement and adamant defending their position when it's pretty clear that they're wrong. In other words, it seems like sometimes the brain kicks in on overdrive when you kind of know you're wrong when you're trying to defend yourself. Is that
correct? Kind of. It's just an idea that, you know, once you're kind of committed to the action, you might feel guilty about it, but since you can't undo the action, your brain will just change its beliefs to stick with your actions.
Yeah.
So the way it, you know, like, to just to say it again, is I'm not really lying. I really did enjoy the experiment.
Right. Right.
Now I'm not lying anymore. Right.
Right.
I think if you ever watched Seinfeld, there's a great quote from George Costanza who once said, you know, it's not a lie if you believe it's true. So all you have to do is just believe your own nonsense, and all of a sudden your conscience is now satisfied. You're not deceiving this person anymore.
Right.
And that reflects in the ratings of the survey. People had a genuinely positive bias now in their responses.
Got it.
So that's the insufficient justification effect. You get people to do something, even if they don't believe it, their beliefs will change to follow their actions.
Got it.
Okay.
Okay.
So now this comes to slide 8.
Okay.
So think about how this applies to what we just discussed earlier. You know, we gain or strengthen a testimony by bearing it. Well, is that because, you know, the Holy Spirit is working some miracle in your heart and rewarding you with an increased testimony? Or
maybe. Maybe.
Maybe. Or is it this other thing that we just demonstrated is a real phenomenon that works on anything?
I just remember on my mission, I really tried to get that witness that I knew the church was true. I felt all sorts of good things, but I didn't. I never got this witness that I knew it was true. So I'm out in Guatemala, and I was told, bear your testimonies if you know it's true, and that'll be what gets you through it. And so I just remember that day where I said, all right, I'll trust you. I'll say I know it's true when I'm actually not quite sure. And I started just saying it. Mm-hmm. And eventually I became quite comfortable saying I know the church is true. And I just stopped thinking about whether I actually knew it or not. I just, it was as if my brain adjusted.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so the key thing that the question that should arise in your brain now at this point is, is this because, some divine miracle is working in me, or could I reproduce this under Catholic conditions? If I get people to bear their testimony of the divinity and the perfection of the Pope?
The infallibility.
Infallibility, the papal infallibility. If you get people to testify to this and behave as if it's true, it'll work there too.
Right.
So this is something to be very careful of and aware of that exists in us, is your evidence should come first and then your beliefs, not the
Got
other
it.
Way around.
Got it.
That is belief first, then action, not action, then belief.
Okay.
Because it works on anything.
Yep. Got
so
it.
This is why religions, Mormons are very big on bearing their testimonies, but this is true of like any Christian denomination. They love to testify constantly. And this is basically what's going on, why they constantly reinforce their beliefs with each other verbally, is because then their brains have to keep up with their own words.
Yep.
So that's the essence of cognitive dissonance theory and how it relates to religious principles.
Okay.
One other point is the ROTC experience. I told myself I was having a good time, and then I suddenly started having a good time.
Yeah.
Again, it's just cognitive dissonance kicking in.
Right.
So now we go to slide number 9. This is a phenomenon called confirmation bias. And this one, one researcher in an article described this as probably one of the most pervasive biases in all of human reasoning.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very subtle, but it's extremely profound. Okay, so the essence of it is simply people have a strong tendency to seek out evidence that confirms what they already believe rather than potentially falsify it or disprove it.
Right.
So there's a very powerful lesson in scientific method here that we'll talk about. Excuse me. So we move along to slide 10 now. So the essence of the experiment is pretty straightforward. You come in, you sit down at a desk, and there is an experimenter there. And he's just going to play a game with you. He says, I'm going to write 3 numbers on the chalkboard here, okay? And these numbers conform to some mathematical rule that I'm thinking of, okay? So he says, I want you to see if you can guess my rule. So the game works like this. You have in front of you a piece of paper and a pencil. He writes his numbers on the board. You think about it for a second, and then you pick any 3 numbers and write them down on the paper in front of you. He will then inspect your paper, look at your numbers, and give you a smiley or a frowny, yes or a no. Yes, these numbers conform to the rule I'm thinking of, or no, they do not. Okay?
Okay.
And you can repeat this as many times as you like. No limit. Just keep writing triplets of numbers until you are absolutely sure you figured out my rule. So that's the whole game. Just write 3 numbers, yes or no. Write 3 numbers, yes or no. Write 3 numbers, yes or no. And keep going until you think you figured it out.
Okay, so give us an example.
So the example he wrote was just 2, 4, 6.
Okay.
Right on the board. Okay, so you look at that. Strictly speaking, there's any number of wacky rules that could produce this 3 numbers. Okay, mathematically speaking. But the obvious rule might be, say, even numbers, incrementing. Okay, 2, 4, 6. So the next set would be like 8, 10, 12, right? So you might be tempted to write down 8, 10, 12. So he comes over, he looks in, he gives you a smiley face. And you'll try a bunch of triplets of the same rules, even numbers incrementing. So, a billion and 2, a billion and 4. Yes. A thousand and 2, a thousand and 4. Yes. And you keep trying and you keep getting yeses, right?
So once you've received a confirmation an apparent confirmation that the conclusion you've arrived at is true, then what you tend to do is just keep applying that rule to everything.
Yeah, that's the key here is people tend – you notice how I just subtly guided our discussion that way, is that this is what people tend to do, is they get a rule in their brain and they just keep testing that very same rule.
Right.
And they keep getting positive results.
And as long as they keep getting the smiley face, they don't really feel any need to try a different rule.
Yeah, and every additional smiley face is just confirmation that you're right.
Got it.
Yay! Except you're wrong. So we go to the next.
How can you be wrong?
Slide number 12. The correct rule was any three increasing numbers.
Oh, so it could have been 1, 2, 3.
Exactly.
But because the first one you saw was 2, 4, 6, you assumed they had to increase by 2.
Exactly.
And because it was confirmed, then you just kept applying that rule.
Yes. So the results is, you know, the experiment, they tried it on 28 people. 22 out of 28 couldn't guess the rule. They just stuck with their idea and kept going with it. Only 4 out of 28, or 6 out of 28, actually got the correct
because answer. They kept getting the smiley face for the increments of 2, and then they said, oh, I know the answer now, and then when they gave it, it was the wrong answer.
Exactly.
Got it.
You keep trying. Eventually, you stop, you raise your hand, and say, I know your rule, and you say, it's even numbers, going up by 2. And he says, no, it was any 3 increasing numbers at all.
So it could have been 1, 5, 7. It could have been 10, 10, 11, 100.
Exactly.
Okay, got it.
So we go to the next slide.
Okay.
And this illustrates a principle called falsification, or an idea of testing alternatives to what you believe. So the problem with just confirming what you believe is that the thing you believe is only a subset of a grander whole. So you keep getting positive and positive results, even though it's completely wrong.
Right.
The way you're supposed to approach it is try different things. So, for example, what if I tried multiples of 4? Oh, I got a smiley face.
That so that'd means be don't 4, 18, 16.
Yeah, 4, 8, 16.
That would disprove the increments of 2 theory.
Exactly. I falsified the previous one by getting a positive result something else.
Got it.
So like you said, I could try 1, 2, 3. I could try multiples of 3, and I don't even have to increment them by 3. So like 3, 12, 21, those are all multiples of 3, and I get a smiley again. Oh, goody. And then the next one, you know, what if I change the order up? Ooh, I got a frowny. So order matters.
So okay. You did 12, 3, 21. That's not increasing order. You get the frowny face, and you know, whoa, it looks like order matters, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And then you might say, well, maybe they'll have to be decreasing or increasing. They can't just be random. So you might try just decreasing numbers, and you get another frowny face.
Right.
The final one, you know, what if, do they have to be whole numbers? Can I try fractions? And so you see 1/2, 6/5, 7/3, you know, and then you get another smiley. So they don't even have to be whole numbers. So, but the key to all this is that you're testing alternatives with each test. You're not just confirming something you already know. You're trying alternatives, and every yes or no answer proves something wrong.
Right.
That's the key.
Right.
You have to prove things wrong in order to get to something that's right.
Got it.
So we go to the next slide here. This is a very key principle, slide 14, called falsifiability. And this is a central tenet of what it means to think scientifically. So there's a quote here from Albert Einstein that says, "No amount of experimentation can ever prove me right. But a single experiment can prove me wrong."
Right.
So this is a very key principle of science, is that nothing in science is genuinely true in that strict capital T.
Yeah, even gravity is still a theory, even though no one would question it, right?
Yeah.
Right?
We believe in, you know, the theory of gravity and Newtonian gravitation or relativistic gravitation. We believe these things because we tried to falsify them and failed.
Yep.
Theories in science are true because they are able to withstand a continuous barrage of attempts at falsification.
Right.
So this is a very key turner, you know, 180 in terms of how to think properly and figuring things out.
Right.
Our very nature is to get an idea in our head and then just stay fixated on that idea and confirm it and confirm it and confirm it.
Yep.
Even though it's wrong,
right,
you keep getting that confirmation.
Yep.
And this is a very pervasive way of thinking. It's natural to want to look at things that way.
So if you learn to say the Muslim church, you know, is the true church as a 5-year-old, you're going to keep sort of viewing the world and selecting your evidence in a way that, that conforms and confirms that conclusion you drew very early.
Yes, we only seek out evidence to confirm what we already believe rather than to potentially falsify what we believe.
And that's, so a, this that's, is why, that's a weakness when we do that.
Yeah, exactly. This is why in science, if you don't have, if you have an idea in science, if it can't be proven wrong, it's useless.
Right.
Because if it can't be proven wrong, it can't be supported or rejected in any sense. It's just random gibberish you spoke into the air at that point. Nobody wants to hear it. So a key principle here is, unless we are willing to be wrong, we can never figure out what is right. Being wrong is awesome in science because it means you have something to learn. You discovered something when you're wrong.
It goes back to that rocket thing. You want engineers for rockets that are going to do everything they can to try and make the thing fail, so that once it's time for it to succeed, it has its best chance of succeeding, right?
Yeah, that's actually a nice way to think of it. Is, you know, do you want to be in the rocket that was put together, you know, ad hoc, or do you want one that people tried to break and couldn't break?
Right, yep.
That's a nice way to think about it. You know, which one would you be more confident in?
Right.
So, you know, one last quote is one that Carl Sagan gives in this regard. And he says, you know, there are many theories and hypotheses in science which are wrong. And that's perfectly all right, because they are the aperture to figuring out what is right.
Yeah.
So, you know, I really just can't stress enough that the expression "I was wrong" is the greatest thing in the world of science.
Yeah.
And you really need to be comfortable with being wrong about things, because a lot of people are not comfortable with that. You know, willing to, you know, the expression, you know, eating my humble pie usually accompanies saying I was wrong about something. Okay. It's not a pleasant experience, but it's something that's really the sign of a intelligent person who cares about truth, who is willing to admit being wrong.
That's one of the things that I think is beautiful and highly ethical about science. You know, you have to publish the detailed procedures of how you arrived at your findings, mm-hmm. and it's only considered legitimate when someone else can replicate it.
Yes.
So it's not trying to hide this thing where, like, I had this experience and everyone's got to believe me. Mm-hmm. It says, no, here's how I did it, and prove it for yourself. That seems highly ethical to me. Mm-hmm. And if you get the example of, like, cold fusion, where a scientist actually is discovered to have falsified data, what happens to the career of that scientist?
It is tanked in a heartbeat.
It's pretty much destroyed, right? I mean, you pretty much can't recover from that in the world of science.
Yeah, it's okay to be wrong, but to fabricate is a ooh.
Oh, yeah, you can be wrong 99 out of 100 times, and that's okay, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah. So, anywho, so moving along now, that's a very important lesson in the beauty of science and scientific method. So now we're going to do another supplement to this idea of confirmation bias. So we're on slide 15, it says belief perseverance. And this is a very related idea to confirmation bias. But the idea basically says, even after supporting evidence for a belief has been discredited, the belief still tends to linger. So as a metaphor, it'd be like building a foundation and then putting a building on it and then tearing away the foundation, but the building just still sits there.
Right.
That's kind of what belief perseverance is.
Once you start believing something, it's hard to change that belief.
Exactly. Generating belief is a lot easier than erasing belief. Yeah. That's kind of the theme we'll see here.
Right.
So next slide 16. This is a fun one because it's so easy and simple how they went through this experiment. So it begins, you know, you sit down, you're going through this, again, you're a volunteer for some psychological experiment, you're this subject. They sit you down and they start asking you questions about who do you think would make a better firefighter. And you're given a dichotomy between risky, gung-ho, maverick type people versus very cautious, by-the-book conservatives. So the, you know, the dichotomy is maverick versus conservative, risky, cautious. Okay. So now, generally speaking, most people don't know the first thing about firefighting other than put water on the fire and it goes out, right? You know, I don't know anything about firefighting. I'm not a firefighter. I don't know any firefighters. So I don't know the first thing about firefighting, and I'm in no position to make the judgment or have any preference between risky or conservative.
Got it.
So rationally speaking, if this is who you are, then you should give a generally neutral response, somewhere in the zero range, right? no preference one way or the other.
And you'll get people guessing either way, and they'll kind of generally equal each other out to zero.
Yeah. And generally speaking, though, the baseline is a slight bias towards Maverick, okay. You know, like plus 1/2 on a scale of -5 to 5.
Okay.
So essentially zero, though.
Okay.
You can kind of approximate it there. And that should make perfect sense. Okay, there's our baseline. So now we go to the next phase of this experiment, slide 17. So they bring up this issue of risky versus conservative firefighters, and they get you thinking about it and talking about it. And then they present you an essay. 5 pages of a comprehensive dissertation written by an expert fireman on why risky firefighters are better than conservative firefighters. Written by Joe Fireman of the Salt Lake City Fire Department with 20 years of experience putting out fires. Okay.
Okay.
So you got this nice golden essay from a genuine expert explaining to you why the one position is better than the other.
Got it.
So with this piece of evidence in hand, it's perfectly natural to feel justified in saying risky firefighters are better, right?
Yep.
You got an expert opinion.
Yep.
So we call that the training condition. So they train the subjects. Here is your essay. Here is what you should believe. And then they give them the survey again. Who do you prefer, risky or maverick now? Well, obviously, they prefer risky. They got this perfectly good essay saying risky is better. So they report risky is better.
Got it.
So you look at the relationship. It's like +2.5 now, more or less.
Okay.
So a nice big positive boost towards preference in favor of the Mavericks.
Okay.
So now comes the fun part, slide number 18. So they go through those motions, the risky versus conservative. Here's this big essay, risky firefighters are good. Now, before they give you the survey, they confess something to you.
Okay, so this is a whole new set of people who they haven't been asked to give an answer yet. They've received the training.
Uh-huh.
And then before they get tested on what they prefer, you're saying something else happens.
Yeah, so yet another condition is piled on to another group of subjects where they confess now, by the way, that essay we gave you, it's bogus. We made it up.
It's not really an expert.
Yeah, we handed it off to some undergrad. He just made up the name and made up the arguments and fabricated the data and the graphs, and just it's all a bunch of complete nonsense. Don't draw any conclusions from it whatsoever.
So first they formed the belief that risky gung-ho Mavericks were better, but they were told, okay, the information that we based that on was not credible.
Yeah, exactly. They basically say, yeah, we made up this essay because we wanted to get you thinking and discussing, you know, just some made up excuse for why they put you through it. And then they confess at the end that it was just a fabrication.
Okay.
Okay. So now, rationally speaking, the foundation has been taken away again. You shouldn't have any preference one way or the other because you were trained to believe something, but they then just took away the foundation. Everything you built that belief on is now...
In theory, it should go back to close to zero, right?
Exactly. In principle, if we were all rational people, it should go back towards the baselines again. But and it's funny because it doesn't. So you look at the graph there, you still see this huge bias towards Mavericks, where all things being equal with no training, they would give about a zero. But then you train them and confess, they still
that the training was bogus.
That belief. So we say the belief perseveres, or it's belief perseverance is the idea.
Once you there's believe no something,
there's no rational basis for the belief, but it lingered anyway.
Yep.
And all you had to do was just implant the idea in their brain and then walk away.
That's like I heard these rumors about they used to show movies where they would flash the popcorn subliminally in the trailers and kind of plant that idea for getting popcorn, and somehow that might influence you later. I guess that's a different level. But.
There is actually a huge body of experiments where they do exactly that sort of thing.
Yeah.
I could probably put together a whole nother half hour or hour slideshow on just those kinds of wacky experiments
where they
flash your images and, you know, subconsciously implant ideas.
Yeah, right.
'Cause it actually works where you won't really see the image, but your brain will. It's kind of funny.
Right. Okay. Anyway.
But that's a kind of a whole separate
topic. Yep.
So we go now to slide 19.
All right.
So it's funny, you know, you might be inclined to think, well, you know, they train them the one way and they'll retain the other way. But it actually works if you do the exact opposite. So the red bars there show training to be cautious. And the exact same thing happened, just with the opposite.
Wow, that's pretty powerful. They looked like almost the exact inflections of each other.
it's great. So this is a very key idea. It is called belief perseverance. You train somebody to believe something, then even if all the justification for it vanishes, they'll still believe it. And they'll believe it no matter how wrong or made up or arbitrary it was to begin with.
Yep.
That's the key. The whole thing, like, nobody to this day knows whether conservative or mavericks are better.
Right.
But the fact that you can train people to believe one or the other,
yeah,
and then admit entirely that they have no justification for that belief.
It's been planted.
And they still believe it anyway.
Yeah.
That's the great thing about this experiment, just how in your face it is.
Yeah.
So the way I kind of look at this is, you know, think about what's physically going on inside your brain when you form ideas and conclusions and beliefs.
Yeah.
When you come to a conclusion, you know, neurons in your brain are physically forming connections at synapses.
Right.
So that idea is hardwired almost literally into your brain.
Yeah, it is. It is.
So what happens when you debunk the idea? Well, you can't forget the hard
wire. Yeah, it's not like the neurons unravel, right?
Yeah, they don't just break apart.
Yeah.
So what happens, in order to, you know, forget an idea, you have to generate a new set of neurons that physically, like, overrides the old set.
Yep, and the old beliefs are still there. You've just overpowered them with new ones.
Yeah, the old beliefs are still there. They just are overridden, like you said.
Yep.
So that is why I think, you know, this idea of belief perseverance exists. It's a fundamental manifestation of the way our brains function.
Got it.
So learning things is a lot harder than forgetting things and correcting things. That's kind of the key. So again, one of those principles of science is you have to be willing to admit you're wrong and stop acting on the belief that was wrong in the first place.
Right.
But, you know, this is a very difficult thing for our brains to do.
Right.
So just another great illustration of the wackiness in human thinking.
Yep.
So now we go to the next slide. You know, think about this now in religious matters. Like, for example, how many religions can you think of that try very hard to indoctrinate children at early ages?
All of them?
Yeah. You know, whether they're right or not, the simple fact that you expose them to these ideas very early and very strongly means no matter how right or wrong the idea is, it's going to stick in their brain for a very long time. And it becomes a very, very difficult and almost traumatic thing for people to give up a religion entirely or to maybe shift faith into a new faith. I mean, you ever just met anyone whose transition out of religion was just a simple, oh, I was wrong and this is a better idea?
It's rare. It's rare.
That rarely happens. It's always this big traumatic thing because it's so ingrained into your brain from the get-go.
And when they say they can leave the church but they can't leave it alone, partly that's because their brain is literally wired, you know, into this stuff. And so you don't just undo that wiring without causing some pretty significant reactions, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So another interesting idea is the Moroni promise itself. So an interesting quote here is from Elder Cook, Gene Cook. And listen to the language he uses to describe how the Moroni promise works. And he says, "The Lord offers us the opportunity to let him confirm truth already in our hearts. But in order to confirm religious truth, one must at least have the idea or the thought or the belief, however small, that he has found something true, and then pray to receive the Lord's confirmation." Now, in light of what we just learned about how easy it is to form a belief, and then once you have that belief, the default perception you'll have in the world is to just confirm the belief.
Right.
So, not that I want to, you know, attack anyone's, you know, testimonies directly, but something that needs to be realized is this action works on anything. It works if you're Mormon, it'll work if you're Catholic, and it'll work if you're Buddhist.
So once it gets planted there, that religious belief, and then your confirmation bias kicks in, and all around you, you're now interpreting whatever you see as confirming that belief you've already, decided upon. You're sort of deeply ingraining your brain to believe that belief for the rest of your life. Yeah.
So it's not by accident that this is something you see, you know, across religious cultures. This is something, I don't want to say it's by design, but it's something that people do because it works.
Yeah. Yep.
So the important thing is, you know, however right or wrong you are at the outset, unless you're willing to falsify things, then that's how right or wrong you're going to forever remain.
Yep.
Okay, so this is why science, again, you know, compare this with what scientific thinking says. It's, you want to put God to the test because you want to know if he's genuinely, this is the truth or not. So you need some potential way to falsify it, not simply come to your conclusion first and interpret everything in that light, because that is a great way to start wrong and stay wrong, no matter what you believe.
Right.
Or a better way, it's a great way to form a belief and hang on to that belief, irrespective of whether it's true or not. That's the key.
Got it.
So some take-home points now. Slide number 21. Just a really brief summary of everything we learned so far on this section. So first and foremost, we've seen that human brains are very good at generating beliefs, but not very good at erasing beliefs.
Yeah.
This is a very fundamental point.
Yeah.
Another key point is religion's doctrines work very hard to generate belief without evidence. Because once the belief is there, then everything is interpreted as confirmation
right.
by default.
Right.
So I got a couple of scriptures like, you know, blessed are those who have seen and not have, or blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed. You know, is this really a scientific way to approach the world? Another one, you know, faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. You know, they're doing this deliberately to generate the belief first so that you will see the evidence later.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So, like I said, once a belief is generated, the natural tendency is to seek out evidence that only confirms the belief. However wrong you are at the outset is however wrong you shall forever remain. You have to have some sort of self-correction mechanism
right.
to seek out errors and fix them, not simply reaffirm your preferred position.
Got it.
The importance of science is that it works very hard to avoid this stuff because falsification is the key. It's all about proving things wrong, not about asserting things and reinforcing things we believe to be true. So being wrong is the virtue in science, not something to shy away from. So that's how science corrects us.
And we shouldn't scoff at what science has given us. It's given modern medicine. Yeah. It's given us aviation. It's giving us, you know, mass transportation. It's given us, you know, germ theory and just all sorts of wonderful things that have, you know, extended our lives, that have improved our quality of life. And of course, it's brought us, you know, pollution and other types of things as well. But it's hard to argue with its effectiveness, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
there's a great expression that says, you know, if knowledge causes problems, it's not through ignorance that you're going to solve them.
Right, right.
So a great idea of, you know, if science is important, whether you like it or not, it works. For good, for better or for worse, it produces the good.
And if science is failing you, what you need is what?
More science,
right?
Exactly.
Right, right. Gotcha.
So now we go to slide number 22.
Okay.
So this is one, and we should probably tread lightly, is this idea of eyewitness testimony. Many religious faiths are built on eyewitness testimony, including Mormon faith. For example, you know, the entire faith, everything about Islam is contained in the Quran and the writings of Muhammad. But everything about the nature of God and the reality of things that we know about Islam and the reality of the Quran is just in the Quran. We're supposed to take it on the say-so of the guys who wrote this book that what he says is true.
So Muhammad has an experience and we're all supposed to believe him.
Yeah. And by a similar situation, you know, think about the four Gospels of the New Testament. Right? They are all secondhand eyewitness hearsay testimonies written decades after the events being described. You know, how much stock do you want to put in that kind of a standard of evidence? You know, if somebody tells you he saw Bigfoot or Elvis, you know, are you going to take him at his word? You know, what if 5,000 people all collectively claim they saw Elvis? Does that really mean Elvis came back to life?
Right.
You know, it's a fundamental idea that how much can you trust the word of other people? And we're going to see the answer, spoiler, is simply you can't. It's very bad. You got to be very careful on how much you trust eyewitness testimony. So to jump into that, we'll go to slide number 23. So this is a fun little experiment, the hit versus smashed experiment. So imagine, again, you're a subject, you're volunteering for an experiment. They sit you in a chair and they show you a video of two cars coming to an intersection and bashing into each other. Okay, so in reality, the cars were only going 25 miles per hour. But your job then, they ask you, is simply how fast were the cars going when they hit each other? Now, a fun fact, people aren't very good at measuring velocity by looking at things. And so when they ask you this question, people tended to respond higher than the truth. And it came in around 34. So it's actually not relevant to the experiment, but it's a fun fact that people are really terrible at estimating velocities of things. But it actually gets worse than that. Because then you can take that group, grab another one, show them another video, two cars colliding with each other. You then ask them the same question, how fast were the cars going when they smashed each other? Same question, just a different verb, hit versus smashed. And it turns out the verb you use to ask the question actually changes the response you get. Hit comes in around 34 miles per hour. Smashed will come in at over 40 miles per hour. An actual, you know, detectable, reproducible difference in responses based on nothing more than the verb you use in the question. So this is why leading questions are bad. You have to be very, if you want honest information from people, you have to be extremely careful in how you ask them for the information, because they'll actually listen to the question itself and use the words in your question to bias their response.
Wow.
So that's just a primer to the next set of the experiment. So now we have what's called the misinformation effect. We're on slide number 24. So you have that experiment again. You show some people two cars crashing into each other. You then wait a week and you have them fill out some essay and questionnaires. And buried in it is the question, did you see broken glass? Now the correct answer is no, there was no broken glass. So without any conditioning or priming, out of 50 subjects, 6 of them said they saw broken glass. 44 said no, no broken glass. So for the most part, people tended to be getting it correct. So then now you repeat the experiment on another group. You show them the video, two cars crash into each other. You then ask them how fast were they going when they hit each other. And they get their answer. You wait a week or so, bring them back, and you give them this, you know, follow-up study. And the question again, did you see any broken glass? Now, what's funny is the hit group actually didn't really perform any differently from the control. That is, they just said 7 out of 50 as opposed to 6 out of 50. So very no significant change. Now the fun part is the smashed group. So again, you get a bunch of people, show them the video, two cars crash into each other. How fast were the cars going when they smashed into each other? So they give their answer, you wait a while, come back, you do the follow-up, and again, did you see any broken glass? So the key to this is the smashed group was twice as likely as the controls to say, yes, we saw broken glass. 16 out of 50 as opposed to 6 out of 50. A huge disparity all of a sudden. More people saying they saw broken glass.
So just the change of a word of how you ask a question can actually make people more likely to say that they saw something that they actually could never have seen.
Or another way to think of it is the question you use to describe the event or ask about the event literally changes the memory of the event in the subject.
Right.
You say smashed, and so they replay it in their mind as something more violent than it really was. And then that replay actually becomes the new memory.
Right. Yep. Memory is very malleable.
That's the key. Yeah. Is memory is not this static thing we like to think it is. It's hugely malleable, and it updates based on nothing more than just the questions you ask about the events.
Yeah, this is really
That's kind of the freaky part is, you know, as you're trying to reproduce the event and describe it, the simple act of being asked about it changes your memory of it.
And then maybe over time you can ask lots of things, and that's probably where we get, you know, the fish story of where the fish keeps growing each time the story gets retold, because over time memories morph. It's not that someone's necessarily a liar. It's just that the brain can add things based on prompts and cues and memories and other things, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And that's an important thing to realize is, like, this is like the most sterile laboratory conditions you can get.
Yeah.
You know, here's a video, here's a question, what do you say?
Yep.
And they're trying to be like as gentle and unbiased as they can. And this effect is still very detectable and prominent.
Right.
So then you just imagine, what about the more chaotic world where you have social pressure and maybe even desire to prefer one response over another and so on?
And you're basing it on emotion instead of something you saw.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, you cried or you felt a tingly thing, and that's what you're trying to, you know, use as evidence, right?
Exactly, yes. So this is a huge stake through the heart of eyewitness testimony. It's something you just cannot rely on very implicitly.
Right.
So now this brings us to the next slide, slide 25. What happens if I throw peer pressure into the mix? Okay.
Right, I think we know.
Yeah, what do you think is going to happen here? So this is a fun little quickie experiment. I just like the title. It says, "I still think it was a banana. Memorable lies and forgettable truths."
That's the title that's of the article.
The title of the paper, yeah. So the experiment, basically, you see an image here in front of you of some kitchen. Okay, and you can see there's some chairs, there's a painting on the wall, there's a stove in the back, some dangling lights, a fruit bowl, some hardwood floor, and so on. Okay, so you're told you're going to see this image for 2 minutes. Try and study it as best you can because we're going to test you. There will be a test. So it's just a simple little memory experiment. So we go to the next slide, slide number 26. You're then probed about specifics of the image. You know, what color was the painting in the back? Or, you know, was there one refrigerator or two or things like that? But the key question was, you know, did the fruit bowl have a banana or not? Did you see a banana? Okay, so the correct answer was actually no. If you go back,
there's just like lemons. There's lemons, but no banana.
Right? Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
So all things being equal, people were about 70% accurate with this. So that's kind of the baseline. Okay,
so 70% they say no, there's no banana?
Which is the correct answer.
Okay. Right.
Right. So then to shake it up a little, they put a Confederate there with you. So before you can give your answer, you have to listen to someone else give his answer.
It's not six, it's just one.
Just one guy, yeah. And he says, yes, I absolutely saw a banana. He sounds very confident in his response.
Right.
So just simply listening to someone else say, I saw a banana, what do you think happens to other people in their responses?
Their memory, right?
Yeah. And they actually are more wrong now because they have this influence giving them incorrect information. So with the Confederate there, the accuracy went from 70 down to 50%. And just from one guy simply just saying, yes, there was. And people suddenly start saying, yeah, I remember there being a banana, sure.
Right.
That's called a sort of an extension of the misinformation effect coupled with informational influence of other people around. Just the simple presence of other people updates our memories.
Got it.
That's kind of the key there.
Got it.
So now let's go to slide 27.
Yeah, so how does this relate to religious experiences?
So, yeah, this is a great example of this exact phenomenon called the Transfiguration of Brigham Young.
Now, where'd you get this? This is brilliant. Just kidding.
There's a paper right there, actually, The Making of a Mormon Myth.
So this is not a dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought, 1995. Uh-huh. It's an article.
Yeah, this guy went through all the journal diaries of all the people involved in this event and put together a nice reconstruction of what happened. So the date is August 8th, 1844. Right after Joseph Smith was martyred, you have this power vacuum in the Mormon Church. Who's going to be the next president? So Brigham Young and Sidney Rigdon were the two guys competing for the presidency now. So they actually got together in like this big town hall setting and had kind of this public debate with each other where they both, you know, bashed on each other and explained why they were the rightful successors to the church. So what happened was eventually Brigham Young won out, obviously, and Sidney Rigdon was soundly defeated by just the sheer awesome force of Brigham Young's oratory skill. So reading the journal entries and diary entries of everybody who was there at the event that day, that's basically what they recorded. Yes, Brigham Young gave a nice speech, and it was awesome. He has the rightful president of the church. The end. Okay. It's funny. He even mentions in the article that like there's actual recorded minutes of the event. You know, somebody was there writing down events as they happened minute by minute, basically. And that's what he records. You know, Brigham Young stomped Sidney Rigdon. The end. Now, the funny part is decades later, after the fact, this rumor started somehow that Brigham Young somehow transfigured himself into the spirit of Joseph Smith.
So, like, you could even see his, Joseph Smith's face on Brigham's face, or somehow when Brigham spoke, you could hear Joseph Smith's voice. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. That's how people suddenly started describing this event. And you have, like, diaries and journal entries written decades after the fact, where they just completely invented this event out of nothing. And the really funny part is some people, in particular, name by name, John Lee and Orson Hyde, they record this event in their journals, even though they weren't actually at the event to see it.
Yeah, so they were like still traveling abroad. Uh-huh. So they couldn't have been there at the actual meeting.
Exactly.
But somehow, after hearing the story so much and memories got fuzzy, they recorded in their journal that they were there, even though we know they weren't. And not just that they were there, but because they had heard other people tell the story about the Transfiguration, none of them being contemporaries necessarily, none of them having experienced that Transfiguration themselves as contemporaries. These people who weren't even there, just from their suggestion, not only wrote that they were there, but that they also experienced the Transfiguration, right?
Yeah, exactly. So this is a great example of the extent to which misinformation can spread in our memories. Because, you know, I don't doubt for a second that these guys were completely sincere.
Yeah, it's not that they're liars, right?
They're not liars. They probably believed what they reported. But, you know, their memory is just so fallible that the mere act of hearing the event from other people caused them to remember it.
Yeah, and the science shows that this is absolutely repeatable in a lab.
Yeah, you can produce this exact effect under laboratory conditions and replicate it. This is just sort of a practical extent of how far it can go if left unchecked.
Right. Yep.
So next slide, final slide, some take-home points here. Human memory is just embarrassingly fallible. This is why, you know, you cannot trust your own memory. It's kind of depressing when you think about it. We like to think of our memory as like some tape recorder that transcribes events and burns them into our brains, and then we just replay them as we need it. Like, no, it's this dynamic thing that updates itself with new information and with social information.
Right.
So human beings tend to subconsciously rely on each other when they construct their memories.
Right.
That's a cue there.
Yeah.
We'll remember things simply because someone else says they saw it.
Yeah.
We'll suddenly our memory will update itself to include that information.
Yep.
And so this is why in science, personal eyewitness testimony is absolutely the least reliable form of evidence. You go to some science guy and say, I saw an alien. He will say, I don't care. I'm sorry.
Right.
It's not useful to me. You know, bring me the ash. Neil deGrasse Tyson would say, you know, bring me the ashtray off the spaceship and we'll talk about it. But
right.
I can't go on your word. Sorry.
Right.
Just not reliable. So ridiculously error prone that we just have to throw it out entirely. You can't trust it.
Yeah.
So this has some very serious implications. Like, for example, I alluded earlier, the entire New Testament is built on nothing more than the say-so of a bunch of guys. How do we know Jesus rose from the dead? Well, because a bunch of guys wrote it down and said so. Like, all the evidence for all the events within the Bible are contained solely within the Bible itself. That is an important thing to bear in mind when you're, you know, studying Christianity and the history of the Gospels in the Bible. Another important thing is the Bible was edited after the fact. The events were written down, and then a council, a literal committee, had to pick and choose which things could go into the Bible and which things couldn't. So, you know, again, are you going to trust these guys to be very objective and and what is real and what isn't, or they just, you got to be careful.
Right.
And again, you know, I don't want to feel like I'm just picking on Mormons and Christians, because this is true even if you're a Muslim. You know, everything about the Quran is buried. All the evidence for the events in the Quran are contained in the Quran itself. Is that really a standard you want to live by? And of course, you have ideas of testimony meetings, our own personal experiences. You know, you may have an experience in your life where you felt like something very profound happened, but honestly, maybe it didn't. You have to be open to the fact that your memory is not very reliable and that it will change as you retell the event and get more exciting and interesting.
Right.
So these are important things. This is why we just, in science, we do not accept eyewitness testimony. We just reject it outright. Unless you can show it physically, we just aren't going to accept it.
So you videotape it, you audio record it, you know, you do whatever you can.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Got it.
Okay, so that brings us to the end of part two.
All right. So thanks, James Nagel, for this part two of the psychology of religion on Mormon Stories. Check us out at mormonstories.org. You can comment on this episode or other ones. Make sure and check us out at youtube.com/mormonstories for the video. And we've got a couple more parts coming, which I think are going to be fascinating. So thanks for sticking with us, and we look forward to joining you again very soon. Thanks, James.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. Music today was provided by the Saber Rattlers. Check them out at saber-rattlers.com. The Mormon Stories logo was generously donated by StudioCase.com. Thanks for listening.
Come, come, ye saints, no toil nor labor fear, but with joy wend your way. Though hard to you this journey may appear, grace shall be as your day. Tis better far for us to strive our useless cares from us to drive. Do this and joy, your hearts will swell. Should we die before our journey?